Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Was there nothing worth fighting for? We are called to find something in our lives worth fighting for.
It almost curdles my womb dry. These stories. Girl parties in Steubenville. Watch her drink. Watch her pass out. Watch them grab wrists and ankles. She is now a rope. They jump. Three girls. No. They're women now. 10 years chains in a Cleveland basement. Did each one give thanks when he skipped her? When he visited that one, when he got her full of stillborn baby, baby girl in Gretna, Louisiana, stuffed into a garbage bag. Show me her mother, how she clenches her fists. It seems we women must practice how to lose our daughters, because I know the boys who will help me carry grocery bags, and then we'll whistle, we'll whisper, will crook fingers in my daughter's direction, and she may flip her hair. She may buck her hip. She may accept their invitation to chill behind paint chip staircases. The cheap vodka may burn her throat, but not how they will. Later, when they become more thrust than thought, and you can't tell me that they don't know that her no is not a moan. When she wakes me, her bed puddled in piss, I will scrub these hands raw. I will tremble at what they could not prevent. So I have to hold every smile of my future daughter tipped up to the milk of this promise. She will not walk hunched, fingers playing with one another as if she can wring prayers from the sweat between her palms. My daughter will not be a girl forced to turn herself into a corner, taught that her body is a place to huddle, hide. I won't raise her to be nice, to give her laugh away, to smile polite as men plot and plan to turn her body into a weapon of war. And if they try, she will know how to wield herself. Don't tell me it's wrong to want to raise a child in this kind of fear. I know for every finger that we loosen, another knuckle grows back crooked. Another knuckle is looking to crack into my daughter's skin. And I can't trust this world to teach their sons how to treat my daughter. So I'll raise her to be a sword, a shield, a spear, to turn class 10s into heated hatchet, to hold razors between her teeth, to cut unkind advances with the sharpest eyes, to hold all of this together with leather or lace, to be chiseled, prepared for rebellions against her flesh. My daughter will be carved from hard rock, sharpened shrapnel, a spear, her body ready to fling itself, an arrow, the hand of the first man who tries to cover her mouth.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
That was a recording of Elizabeth Acevedo reading her poem Spear. I'm Blaine Harrison from Mystery Jets, and this is episode 3 of our podcast, Things Worth Fighting For. I hope wherever you're listening to this, you're keeping well and managing to stay sane. During this slightly surreal and difficult time, we're inspired to create a safe space for amazing people from different backgrounds to share stories of activism and to shed some light on some of the biggest conversations of today, many of which have inspired the songs on our new album, A Billion Heartbeats. I'm speaking to you today from Mystery Jet's basement studio in Clerkenwell, London, 3 months into lockdown, and the theme we're talking about on today's episode is female role models and gender equality. You may very well be asking yourself what place a man, me, has in a discussion about the female experience. Well, sort of. The dictionary says a feminist is someone who advocates social, political, and economic rights for women equal to those of men. It may sound obvious, but I think this bit's quite important to point out. Women's rights are human rights. So I would argue that both women and men can be feminists. This isn't just something that should concern half the people on the planet. There are, of course, times when male voices aren't wholly welcome within the discussion. And on occasions, many of us get it wrong. But perhaps it's important to get it wrong sometimes, because maybe that's how we learn. Surely by having the difficult conversations, we educate ourselves and begin to recognise what it means to become a more useful ally to the opposite sex, calling out discrimination when we see it in our friends, family, co-workers, but most importantly, in ourselves, accepting that as men, we individually may at times have been part of the collective problem. And that problem, of course, is called the patriarchy. Or as Grayson Perry calls it in his book, The Descent of Man, the Department of Masculinity. It's a system as old as history itself, designed by men in positions of power to maintain their dominance in society. To examine it, we need to look little further than the fight for equal pay in the workplace, the marketing of beauty products, representations of female sexuality in culture, conversations around abortion rights, gender roles in parenting, and good old-fashioned catcalling. Tracing the word back to its Greek origin, patriarchy literally means rule of the father. If, like me, that makes you think of Darth Vader, then destroying this thing understandably sounds like a gargantuan feat, a bit like blowing up the Death Star. But I would argue that just by questioning it, and in doing so, acknowledging its existence, we're already well on the way. My journey with the conversation we're exploring on today's episode really began in January of 2017 in a small town called Seyðisfjörður on the northeast coast of Iceland. I had booked myself a month off to explore the country in search of new songs and a clearer headspace away from the constant grind of living in London. One afternoon, I was hiking up a glacier and saw that for the first time in a few days, I had some bars of data on my phone. Checking in with friends on social media, I saw my timeline had become flooded with images from the Women's March in London, Paris, Berlin, Tokyo, and across the whole of America. And all of this the day after the most notoriously chauvinistic public figure in modern times had become the elected leader of the free world. It was the largest single-day protest in US history. Heading back to the guest house I was staying in, I felt a sense of conflict. Here I was in this serene glacial wonderland, surrounded by nature, Yet all of a sudden, I recognised a strong force pulling me home. History was happening in the streets, and I knew I needed to be there to witness it. Back in my room, I began working on a new song in which I wanted to celebrate the strong women who have been a guiding force in my life, as well as the sense of pride I feel seeing friends of mine with young daughters instilling those same strong values in them. The name of that song was History Has Its Eyes on You, and you'll get a chance to hear it in its entirety at the end of this episode. Elizabeth Acevedo is a Dominican-American poet and author from Washington, D.C. Coming up through the slam poetry scene and spending time working with incarcerated women as an English instructor, she's gone on to become a New York Times best-selling author and recipient of the National Book Award for Young People's Literature. I stumbled across her work when someone shared a performance of her reading the poem you just heard, Spear. I was gripped by the passion in her voice and touched by the sentiment of writing to both her future self as a mother as well as to her future daughter, warning of the injustices and violences of a world she has not yet been born into. She said the purpose of her poetry is to elevate women's experiences into stories so as to allow them not to be forgotten, whilst also longing for a day when they'll become dusty artifacts in a museum, no longer necessary in an equal world. Another powerful voice belongs to the guest I'm about to speak to. Our guest on today's episode of Things Worth Fighting For is a 21-year-old artist, influencer, and soon-to-be-published author, Florence Given. Florence is perhaps best known for her bold, slogan t-shirts and designs addressing issues of sexuality, race, and empowerment. Dump him. Offer a shag and stop raising him, he's not your son, are all messages which have appeared in her work, making powerful statements on role models and gender politics in today's complicated age of social media. Unlike some of the episodes in this series, which were recorded face-to-face before lockdown times, my conversation with Florence took place through a screen and therefore was subject to the occasional glitchy gurgle, but thankfully she kindly recorded our chat at her end too. I hope you enjoy our conversation, and I'll meet you on the other side. Florence, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Yeah, so we were going to chat at the end of last year, but I know you've been incredibly busy with the book.
Yeah.
It's now done, and it's, I think by the time this goes out, it's going to be out in the world. But actually, just before we talk about the book, I want to ask you the question that 95% of the entire population of the world is asking each other at the moment, which is how are you coping with the situation that we're in?
Yes, I've actually been really well. I'm really good at distracting myself, but in a way that is not avoiding my emotions, because that's not something I like to do. I like to feel my feelings. I like to process them. I'm still going to therapy on FaceTime weekly. I'm making sure that I am consistently checking in with myself, but also kind of avoiding the reality of what's going on outside. And I've been going on bike rides. I actually have a lot of social anxiety. So the fact that there's not a lot of people on the streets means I'm able to go on bike rides and not feel overwhelmingly anxious about street harassment and stuff like that. So that's great.
Do you know what? I can really relate to that because I live in central London, but I can definitely relate to the feeling of suddenly when you've got the street to yourself. And I think this probably especially applies as women, you know, like there is, it's a whole different, you know, sense of freedom and not being
Absolutely.
Surrounded by judgment and all these things.
Yeah, I've not ridden a bike in London since I moved here 2 years ago because of that exact reason. And it was like this huge internal barrier that I wasn't even aware of until there was all of a sudden absolutely no one on the streets. So that's been incredible for my mental health and for me just like getting out and seeing London in a way that I've never seen it before, not just because the streets are dead, but because I'm riding a bike. So that's been really instrumental to me kind of being okay with this. I'm also a massive introvert. So this time alone just feels more like recharging of my batteries. I imagine this is really hard for people who are extroverted, who need the energy from other people. It does get lonely, absolutely. I miss my friends. I miss physical touch. I miss hugging people, yes. All of that kind of stuff. And I think that does contribute to how you feel. I mean, like touch deprivation has a link to depression. So it's going to make people feel lonely and stuff. And I'm also allowing myself to feel that way. I'm allowing myself to honor the fact that this can be lonely. It's been like two and a half months, is it? I don't freaking know. Like,
yeah, about that.
How long it's been in it. Yeah.
I think that's a really interesting thing that you said, which is that allowing yourself to feel lonely, because I think so much of the time we are, you know, we're chasing fulfillment in so many different ways, aren't we? And actually, sometimes we almost need to validate the feeling of being down and being depressed and to be accepting of that feeling.
Yeah, especially me, because my message is to encourage women to feel happy being single, right? But there are dualities to every experience. You know, I'm so happy. I've been single for over a year and a half now, and I'm using this time to intentionally demand better for myself. I've spent a life of people-pleasing, of being a fucking doormat to everyone. And the minute I realized that I'd been, you know, abuse is never your fault, but when you realize that you have a say in how other people treat you, you know, you tell people how to treat you, and you don't have to put up with certain remarks or certain things that people throw your way. When I realized that, and that the answer to better treatment was for me to assert myself, which I've been so afraid of my whole life, because I think as women we're encouraged to not be a bitch or to be assertive, all of that kind of stuff. When I realized that, I was like, wow, I need to be so intentional with who I spend my time with now and who I date and who I'm friends with. And so that's what I do with my work, is I'm encouraging women to rather be single than stay in a toxic relationship for the sake of having a partner, you know. And I think the normalization of abuse in relationships is romanticized. We see it in TV series and films, and for a lot of people it can be, they'd rather be in a toxic relationship than no relationship at all. So I do champion being single a lot, but I think it's also important to acknowledge that, yeah, I mean, I'm single and I live on my own. So because of that, I am going to feel lonely and I do miss physical touch, and that's okay to feel. And being in a big city like London as well, my friends live bloody everywhere. Like, there's no small community of people, that everyone's just kind of spread out. And I think it's really important to talk about the importance of loving your own company, which I do, but also you do need human beings in your life. Like, that's how we live, right?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose just talking about being single, because I know it's something that, you know, you engage a lot with in your art and in your work. I mean, I suppose there's perhaps this sort of societal assumption that being single is a temporary thing rather than a choice.
Yes.
This idea that we're waiting for the perfect partner, or we're waiting for the right situation, the right time. But I think your take on this is really interesting. I know I've heard you talk about it.
Yeah. So being single is the art of not lowering your standards to fill a hole in yourself, right? It's different for people depending on their perceived desirability. I have so much privilege being white, slim, cisgender, and I'm able-bodied. So I have so much privilege in that my dating pool, like the options for my dating pool, are a lot wider than other people. And it's really important to acknowledge that. People don't like to talk about pretty privilege or this kind of stuff, but it's real. And I'm treated better just for existing in the body that I am. And it's important to acknowledge that. So it's all good me saying, you know, being single is a choice. For some people, it is harder to find a partner, perhaps because of where they live, because of their ability or class privilege, or all this kind of stuff. But whoever you are, just the state of being single, it's a testament to the fact that you're not settling.
Yes.
Because, do you know what I mean? It's like, so for a while I viewed it as this kind of, this, like, you're thrust into the state of being single and it's like, shit, I must get out of it. Even everyone else around you acts like they need to help you get out of it. It's like, oh, I can set you up with this person. And especially queer, like, so many of my friends will say to me, oh, I've got this friend who, like, she's gay, or, you know, and it's always kind of like, just because two people are queer, they assume that we'll get on, or all this kind of stuff. It's forced upon you to get out of being single. And I hear this, I don't actually feel that urge in me at all. I find more pride for myself at this point in my life anyway, in being single and demanding better for myself and saying no to things that aren't good for me. And with dating apps, there are so many options, and there are so many times where I've been faced with old patterns, or I can see myself falling into something that isn't healthy for me. And it takes starting yourself and saying, you know what, I deserve better than this, to not fall back into those patterns.
Because that same sort of sense of validation that, you know, we're all familiar with from social media exists in online dating as well, doesn't it?
Absolutely. It's such a quick, fleeting sense of that you mean something. I've written about this in my book, that I often grab my phone if I was feeling low and open up Tinder. When I realized that I did that, I just literally watched my arm grab my phone and I was like, oh my God, that was like my knee-jerk reaction. I'm feeling low right now. My knee-jerk reaction was to get validation that I'm desired. And I think that also speaks a lot to how women are taught to view themselves, is that if they are not desired, they are not worthy. Yes. And a lot of my work is about encouraging women to know that they are valuable simply because they occupy their bodies, not because of how their body looks like, but because they and their own minds occupy their bodies, therefore their body is valuable. And yeah, there's so much messaging around being single that's so negative ourselves.
You've described your book, Women Don't Owe You Pretty, as a book for young women trying to determine feminism on their own terms.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it wasn't out at the time of recording this, but I did have a scan over the chapter titles. And the title of the penultimate chapter in the book really interested me. Feminism will ruin your life in the best way. I absolutely love that sentiment. What do you mean by it?
Okay, so you imagine we're currently swimming in all of these narratives that we are told about ourselves and about other people our entire lives. And the more privileged you are, the more you're blind to the toxicity that you are enabling, the toxicity and privilege that you benefit from, and also the stuff that is affecting you as a person as well. And I think the more you become aware, it's so fucking uncomfortable because you're literally unraveling your entire identity. It's so uncomfortable. That's why I say it's going to ruin your life. It's going to ruin the way you see things. It's going to ruin your friendships because you'll realize, holy shit, I've been in low-key abusive friendships, or I've done some abusive behaviors, or I've permitted stuff. And you kind of cringe at your past self. And that is so uncomfortable. But you've got to use that cringe as a catalyst for growth. And that is why I say feminism will ruin your life in the best way possible, because you're going to have more enriched friendships as you let go of ones that do not serve you and come into ones which enable your growth. You can't watch films that you enjoy anymore because you're like, holy shit, this is the reason why I view myself this way, because women were betrayed like this my whole life growing up. Mm-hmm. Everything that you love becomes so uncomfortable. I can hardly listen to some of the Rolling Stones music anymore because it's so disgusting. Mm-hmm. And it's like the things you once loved become the things that you realize aren't normal, but have been normalized. And there is so much discomfort in that realization.
I find that really interesting because, in a way, the models of masculinity and femininity change with every era. And the way that we view ourselves, even society's view of what's beautiful, changes with every era. And obviously, like in the age that we're living in now, this kind of information overload age, there's so many questions and there's so much to navigate through. I think it's so cool that you've managed to channel that in, you know, into a book, which is kind of a manual for someone your age or younger or older who's trying to find a path.
Absolutely older.
Yeah.
So I'm 21, but a lot of women who are in their 40s or older message me constantly that they have reflected on their entire marriage because of my work. That is powerful as fuck. And it's because the narratives that they consumed were passed down to them from their mothers. And actually, a lot of the time, it's such a privilege to even be able to examine your life. And it's such a privilege to be able to sit down and go, to kind of reflect, you know, because a lot of people are stuck in survival mode. A lot of people, especially marginalized people and people of color, they are living to survive. Working class people are living to survive. They don't have the privilege of sitting there and going, oh, is the way that my relationship with my husband, am I actually raising him like a son? Or is this normal because women do the housework and men go to work, right? It shouldn't be a privilege because no one deserves to be in these awful, outdated, archaic relationships. But it's also important to acknowledge that some people are living in survival mode and they're not thinking about even escaping because they do not know of an alternative. And Gloria Steinem uses this narrative, this analogy of, it's like being a fish in water. Like, a fish is not aware of an alternative to water because it's surrounded by water. It's not thinking of being an alternative the same way women in abusive relationships don't know of an alternative to abuse. Just to come back to what we're talking about, this definitely would appeal to older women as well. And men, oh my God, because this book hasn't been written for men, that is exactly why they should be reading it, right? Because it's not been watered down. It's not been made palatable for the male gaze. It's my experiences and the experiences of other women entirely unfiltered. So for that reason, I think men should read it, but it's going to be uncomfortable.
Absolutely. I've never written a book before, so I have huge respect for you. But, you know, but I do write songs. And one of the lyrics from one of the songs on our new album is called History Has Its Eyes on You. And the lyric in the song is be who you needed when you were younger.
Absolutely.
I think really what I wanted to communicate with that was that, so me and my sister were brought up partly by my mum, who was single at the time, in rural France. And I felt quite strongly that I wanted to write a song celebrating the strong women I had around me growing up, who have both been huge, huge role models in my life. And I mean, would I be right in saying that with this book, it's almost the book that you wish you'd been able to read when you were younger?
Oh my God, yes. I wish I could whack this book over my head when I was 14. In fact, the introduction to my book is a conversation between me and my 14-year-old self.
Wow.
It's you know, like obviously an imaginary conversation.
Yeah.
But it's that was really important for me to do because it gets the reader to learn. Okay, so the reader may be reluctant to a lot of the concepts and a lot of the experiences I discuss in my book because they are so earth-shattering in terms of your perception, right? Realizing that something you have been doing for your whole life isn't normal, but it's been normalized and it's actually toxic as hell. That's really uncomfortable. So the introduction of my book is a conversation between me and my 14-year-old self. So it's like me talking this person, who's my 14-year-old self, through the understandings of what I'm trying to tell her about prettiness and about this need and niceness and the male gaze. And I'm explaining this concept to her, and you see this person coming to terms with it, right? So all the questions someone might have about what is the male gaze and women don't have to be pretty, they just do it because they like to, no one's forcing them to do this. And then I explain, actually no one is forcing women, but we know that we're gonna have a much easier life if we do this stuff. So you know, it talks the reader through it, and that was really important for me to do. And basically, yeah, I am writing this book for young women especially because I want to introduce the concepts of boundaries before they have to experience it the hard way. And that was what it was for me. I had to learn through awful experiences that led me to go to therapy, you know. And it's like I want to get women introduced to the red flags, and even like how to engage in sex. And I was never taught any of this stuff, I think. And it's just so important to get it in before they learn the hard way, and then they have to learn about boundaries, you know. And I think, yeah, it's definitely a book that I wish I had when I was younger. It would have saved me a lot of awful traumatic experiences.
I don't know if this is sensitive for you to talk about. It probably is, but I understand that you had some bullying at school, which I can relate to, you know, anyone with something unusual about their appearance or their name or whatever will know. Other kids will always find a way to minimize you and isolate you for being different. Mm-hmm. I mean, how did those experiences when you were younger shape your, I suppose, your worldview and perhaps your means to find a way of expressing yourself by making art?
Yeah, I think, oh my God, the whole thing ties into being bullied at high school. It was, I was in a really awful, it was like a codependent abusive friendship where essentially it's the, I hate to be the stereotype, like, but it was a classic, like, if you've seen Mean Girls, it was like, you know, you had the ringleader and then I was like her friend who was just submissive, silent, did whatever she wanted, blah, blah, blah. Then she found out something about me that I was going through and I confided it in to her and she told the entire school and then isolated me. And it was through that isolation and the bullying that followed that I found myself, because I was forced to face the fact that I had been, I basically didn't know how to exist without trying to meet the needs of other people. Mm. And so because I was forced to be, I was 14 years old and I was like reading books on mindfulness and meditating and taking myself for walks and realizing, holy shit, I have so much more worth outside of serving another person. Mm. And it was my GCSE art course, my art teacher, Mr. Varrell, he showed me a fashion illustration book. And I didn't know that you could do a bloody GCSE in art that wasn't like painting roses or some shit. Mm. And I was like, wait, you mean I can like draw women and get a GCSE in art? And he was like, yeah. So he showed me this fashion illustration book, and it was this fashion illustrator called Julie Verhoeven. And she drew women in this really abstract way, like wonky tits and like huge heads and large hair. And I just started to make art. And I used to just, that was my outlet. It was making art. And then when I went to, when I left that school finally and kind of escaped that atmosphere, I went to art college and started to channel my political messages into my artwork and made the stuff that you see today. Then I got into London College of Fashion to do fashion styling and production. And I had my Instagram account. It was very small at the time. I was just putting my shit on the internet, shouting about sexual harassment and all this kind of stuff that I felt was really important, but none of my friends validated my experiences, right? Mm. So I would be going out to the nightclub and when I turned 18 and be constantly harassed by men. And I felt such discomfort with it, but my friends were telling me like, no, like it's a compliment, like what else are you getting dressed up for, like you should be liking this. And there was no one validating how I felt about it. So when I started putting my work online and found that there were thousands of other women who were like, holy shit, so I'm not crazy for not liking this, this is actually disgusting and like boundary pushing behavior from men that we're experiencing, oh great. So then I started putting it online, and then I moved to London. And I did 1 year at London College of Fashion. Then I dropped out. And that was a year and a half ago. So I dropped out of uni a year and a half ago.
Exactly the same boat as you, by the way. I went to art school. I did an art foundation. I started a degree.
Oh, really?
Dropped out after two terms.
Yes, it's I enjoyed it, kind of. Like, I love purpose, and it gave me purpose. It helped me move up to London. But I knew that I was onto something with my work,
yeah.
And I fully just decided to take the leap and drop out because I just believed in what I was doing so much.
I mean, I'm interested in that, you know, in this idea of a fire, because I think some of your work, I'm just thinking about, you know, stop raising him, he's not your son, or you know, offer a shag, something like that, you know, some of these slogans which have gone viral in your work. I mean, do you get that sort of sense of a fire when you stumble across something? Do you have a feeling of this is going to connect with people?
No, I really do not. So,
is it instinctual? It connects with you first?
Oh, absolutely. And I don't release something until I've processed it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, offer a shag, that's just how I talk. Like, my slogans are all just kind of these, like, tongue-in-cheek. I was bored of seeing this wishy-washy people, kind of like wishy-washy feminism, where it was like, people would just be like, love yourself. And not really giving any kind of, okay, but loving yourself involves accountability and you're in a shit relationship with a man, but also you need to hold yourself accountable for like not raising him like a fucking child. Why are you doing that? Maybe think about why you need to give this unreciprocal love and why you don't expect anything in return. You know, no one's telling women that a lot of the reasons they don't love themselves is because of capitalism or is because it's an intentional thing that we all shave our bodies because men wanted to sell more razors in the 1920s. Before that, women didn't even touch their body hair. Mm. And it's about educating women and informing them with this knowledge so they can make a decision about, okay, do I shave my body because I like it? Or is it this idea that actually doesn't even belong to me?
How much do you think your work is directed at yourself, you know, the messages in your work, and how much is written for other people? Because I'm interested in that as a songwriter, because when I'm writing a story, when I'm writing a lyric, elements of that are me. There's parts of me in that sentiment that I'm trying to communicate. But I'm also, part of what I do, and I think what you do, is storytelling. There's a narrative which you're communicating via your work. And how much of that is you trying to, I suppose, enable people to empathize with the message?
I think I'm always talking to the past version of myself, always in my work. Oh my God, like I needed stop raising him. He's not your son. This is what I mean. Everything I do is like I'm shouting it into the ear of the person that I was a couple years ago. And also for the parts of her that still exist in me today. You know, I still have elements of me that are a people pleaser. I still find it so hard to assert myself in certain situations. And I still write some of the, honestly, when I was writing my book, I would often refer back to my own chapters to give myself a boost to remind myself of who the fuck I am. Mm. And it's often this form of, I feel like everyone has like a higher self, right? Everyone has, it's not another figure. It's not a God that, I don't know if you're religious or whatever, but I don't believe in God and all that kind of stuff. I appreciate it, but I do not. And I don't worship, I don't like the idea of worshipping this man. It feels very patriarchal. Mm. I feel like there's this people-pleasing version of myself that I used to be, and this higher version of myself that says no when she wants to and asserts herself in situations where she needs to speak up. And I often feel like I'm in this transition period of being in the middle of those two versions. And so sometimes my work, my own work, does connect to me and empower me and is a message to me to remind myself that I don't have to go back to that old person just because it makes other people feel comfortable or because they're used to that version of me.
Let's talk about influencer culture, because I'm interested in that. You know, you talked about how you're 21, and I mean, having built up such a huge following at that age,
yeah,
is quite unique. You know, I think at the time of this interview, you've got 352,000 followers on Instagram. I mean,
yes.
What kind? that's quite astounding. I mean, what kind of pressure does such a position of influence bring?
Yeah, I think it has the ability to put a lot of pressure on myself, but I don't allow it to because I'm very good with my boundaries with it. Oh my God, the amount of messages I get, Blaine, a day from people asking me for advice and it's such intimate kind of advice that these people are asking me for. They're telling me their entire life story. I don't answer a single one of my messages, and that's one of my boundaries. I'm not an agony aunt, I'm not a trained therapist. And also I'm not being paid to do this. This is free labor that people are asking of me to kind of just dedicate my life to their problems. And that's a boundary that I have, and it's without that boundary, I would be exhausted. I don't have control over how people react to me. Like you said, it's their projections. And with Instagram, God, it's like so quick. People, you put something up and people don't even take the time to sit in their thoughts and reflect. They will project that shit back onto me and tell me I'm an awful person for talking about abusive relationships because it makes them feel uncomfortable. And it's like, yeah, maybe you need to think about that. Why does it make you feel uncomfortable? It's not my fault.
I mean, I think just speaking about social media, this something that we're all familiar with to a certain point is this, you know, the popularity contest of social media that has this huge influence over our sense of self, our self-worth.
Yeah.
You know, there's this figure that on an average day, we scroll through an Eiffel Tower's worth of posts.
Oh my God.
You know, holidays we're not on, bodies we'll never have, parties we're not at, relationships we're not in, diets we're not eating. And I think to a certain extent, we're all complicit in that structure to a point, to varying degrees of addiction or supplying that content.
Yes.
And I think your work engages with that in a really positive way. You know, all of these themes, I think, which feature so heavily in your work, you know, as we were talking about, there's diet shaming, there's domestic abuse, there's trauma, there's victim shaming, male gaze, privilege, consent, all of these worlds, I think, coalesce in your work. But I know you've spoken about you dislike this term activist. I'm interested in that because I think the messages in your work really do, you know, empower your audience, and they ultimately do work towards changing attitudes in society. But what is it about that term that you don't associate with?
It's not that I dislike it. I actually just prefer the word advocate, right? Yeah. I like to. I'm a political creative. I'm a political artist because I don't like to discount the. It's, you know, I'm an artist and I do writing and art, but that is it's very different to people who dedicate their whole lives to this and are working in domestic abuse shelters. And although we're doing the same kind, I'm raising awareness and I am empowering women in the same kind of way. And although that could be similar to what other women are doing, whether they're physically helping or emotionally helping women, I like to use the word advocate. It makes me feel more comfortable to use that word because I feel like activist, I don't feel that what I do is activism. I think it's advocacy. And kind of, yeah, it's my work is fucking powerful and I will never kind of undervalue the work that I have done because I do believe in its power. I see its power every single day and I believe in the power of my words and my art. One of the things that was interesting as well is a lot of people like to diminish or patronize my work because it is very feminine. And that's actually what I like most about what I've been able to do is I've not had to compromise within my art. Like it's very pink and it's very, very feminine. I've not had to compromise my femininity to make an impact. You only have a few seconds to get people's attention. So my work is very provocative. And it's very eye-catching. And that in itself is like a sugar-coated pill. It's like, if my work was just like black and white words, like stop raising him, he's not your son. If it was just like white words on a black thing, people would not be engaging in it the way that they do so viscerally with my artwork of women and my bold fonts. And I think that has such a huge part to play in my message and how it's gone so viral.
I think that's so interesting. That's just what you're saying reminded me of Grayson Perry's book, The Scent of Man.
Yes, yeah, I've read it.
Yeah, there's a really powerful bit in that, and I'm paraphrasing, I wouldn't know the quote exactly,
sure.
But essentially he's talking about in order, you know, in positions of power, in order for a woman to be taken seriously, she needs to wear a suit, she needs to adopt the uniform of the strong, you know, powerful
masculine
white male. Yeah, that model. Yeah. And I think what you're doing with your art, it makes me think about that because what you're saying is that actually I don't need to compete with men that are occupying the same space.
The standard that they've set, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I think you're not trying to dress your work in a uniform for it to be taken seriously in any particular cultural space. It's representation of your colour and your views and your personality. And I think that's one of the most inspiring things about it, I think.
Thank you. I mean, I'm a very existential person. So on a daily basis, I'm like, how much of my femininity though is who I am and how much of it is just a product of how I've been raised to believe I should be? Because I do so closely align to femininity, right? The role I was assigned at birth. I love pink. I love all things feminine. I'm also leaning a lot more into my masculine as I question these kind of things. And I just think it's about encouraging women to see that there is no one way that you can exist in this world, that you are literally going to be judged either way. Because when men don't see you as desirable or that they see you as more masculine, you're less seen, you're less visible, but you're more respected, right? And when you're more feminine, you're more hyper-visible, but you're not as respected as much because you're feminine. And it's either way, I feel like women rarely have the opportunity to experience being seen and heard at the same time. And what I love is that I've been able to create a space where I am seen and heard and validated by women. You know, I'm a 5'4" blonde 21-year-old woman. I could not enter some kind of corporate scene and be respected in the way that I am as an influencer or as someone on Instagram who gets to tell people who I am before they make assumptions about me. And that is the power of social media, is that especially for marginalized people and trans people and fat people and disabled people, they get to tell their own stories before being assumed of who they are. They don't get to be stereotyped, although they will be sometimes. You know, I'm always stereotyped. If you just take like one look at me or my image, people would never think that I talk about the things I do or that I am an outspoken queer woman. Even I'm always assumed to be straight, and it's all of this stuff. That's why social media is great, because you get to tell your own narrative.
I suppose what that's making me think about is something else you've talked in your work, is the concept of internalized misogyny. So
yes,
that it's this kind of silent killer in the feminism movement, because there's this kind of misguided belief that there isn't enough room for all women to be celebrated in society and cultural spaces without tearing each other down. And I think you made, and I think you've spoken about this today, you've made a very interesting connection with that and consumer capitalism and the, the, you know, this sort of, this essentially like the marketing of cosmetics and clothes to make people, to make women feel better about themselves, whilst at the same time, you know, like the media constantly injecting this, this, these insecurities into the way.
I mean, your prettiness will be used against you. This is a thing. It was created, prettiness as a beauty standard was created so that women would have this distraction to play with and to bother ourselves with. So we're not even thinking about asking for that raise because we're too busy thinking about how we look while we do it. You know, it's all these surveys that show women don't put their hands up in school because they don't want anyone to look at them in the classroom because we are hyper-conscious of our image. All of this kind of things, self-esteem is everything. And if you don't even feel confident enough to assert yourself or to feel like you belong in a classroom, that is going to follow through the rest of your life. And prettiness as a standard, anyway, it's used as this thing that, you know, women know if, you know, we don't have to shave our legs, we don't have to wear makeup, we don't have to perform femininity, but we know that if we do, we will save ourselves the unsolicited remarks. We will save ourselves the comments on our bodies. We will save ourselves. And it also opens more doors for us if we look pretty, right? But then also that prettiness will be used against you to dismiss your thoughts, to dismiss your opinions, and also be used against you to explain and justify your sexual assault. It's, we live in this weird dynamic where you literally cannot win either way. You pick your poison. You say, okay, do I mute my authentic self? Do I shave my legs? Do I put on this face of makeup and then be treated better? Or do I be myself and be treated like a piece of shit? So you choose every single day before women get up to go to work or whatever it is, before they're stepping out their door, we don't look at ourselves. We look at how other people look at us. We've got this surveillance inside of us that everything we do is analyzed of how we will be perceived through the lens of the male gaze. Basically, the book, I want to lead the reader to the realization that whether they apply prettiness or not, it's going to be at an expense either way. You're either going to mute your authentic self, which can be debilitating. People become depressed from muting their authentic self their entire lives and performing the roles that was applied to them, or they can perform them and be treated better. You know, it's like, do you conform or do you not conform? But I think as long as you're aware of what you're doing, that's when you allow it to not affect you as much, when you become aware of what you're doing and how it's impacting your life.
Absolutely. You know, as an artist, as a band, like we play a lot of festivals, and obviously there is a huge conversation which us and many artists are part of, which is equal representation at festivals. This very antiquated attitude of box ticking, whereby historically, well, we've got a female artist on that stage.
Why do
we need another? You know, we've got a female headliner for the Friday. Why do we need another one? And suddenly, what you can see is historically how that's become hugely problematic for women in my industry, because there is a limited amount of space on these cultural platforms, and so women end up being or feeling like they're pitted against one another in order to get the seat at essentially what is a man's table. They need to destroy their competitors.
So it's like this feeling we talk about of internalized misogyny. Sometimes it's not even in our heads, you know. Sometimes it, you know, sometimes we have this competitiveness among women because we are taught to compete with each other, you know. This feeling that we have about women being competition, it's a valid one, because there are structures in place which do make us do this with each other. Even the fact that so many of my friends who are in bands or who are artists will be referred to as female musician or female artist, and all that does is imply that artist is inherently male. And I catch myself doing this all the time, because, you know, you'd never hear like this male musician.
Absolutely.
You know, it's always, he's a musician or they're a musician, and it's, oh, she's a female musician. Yeah. And it's constantly, I catch myself doing it all the time.
It's othering. You're othering people of a certain gender. I mean, it's interesting because I'm someone with a disability, so I identify as part of the disabled community in the UK. And as do 1 in 10 people. I mean, it's a huge statistic, and I think that's something that, you know, and the disabled community has felt a lot, is that there's this sort of tokenistic view, obviously, where, you know, it's a minority as opposed to 50% of the population, over 50% of the population. But there is this sort of box ticking aspect to it, whereby it's for political correctness. We need to be seen.
Oh God,
to be supporting.
I can't imagine.
And I know obviously that's a huge issue.
It's so patronising. It's a different kind of othering with the disabled community because it's patronising as hell, isn't it?
Absolutely. And it feels tokenistic. It feels like, well,
yeah,
the society or the media needs to be seen to be making these, yeah, people visible as opposed to actually working with
them.
Yeah, like seeing society as a meritocracy, which is that actually, people should be able to succeed based on what they're bringing to a situation, as opposed to, oh, we need to get this guy in because he, you know, ticks a certain box. This is a box ticking.
Yeah.
I could talk about this for 5 hours, but I'm not going to.
Yeah.
I suppose, like, one of the things I'm interested in is education. You know, you've talked about how your book is almost this handbook for your younger self. It's just zooming back a few years. I mean, do you feel like the education was there for you, either like in a parenting capacity or like in a school capacity, to navigate your place in society or like in a societal, yeah, group? So I suppose what I'm talking about is gender politics coming into our education.
Oh God, yeah, no, I had absolutely none of it. I mean, I learned about the suffragettes when I was like 13 years old. But even then, you know, we weren't taught about the intersectional aspect of that feminism, and that black women didn't get the vote until much later, and actually a lot of the suffragettes were racist. So there was a lot of erasure in the history that I was taught of feminism. Everything that I have learned about my own experience and everything that I have had to look to validate my own experience as a woman has come from me, like, meticulously ravaging the internet, ravaging my resources, and kind of having to find these pockets, you know? So that's why I've tried to kind of blow it up and make it as in your face and unavoidable as possible. Like, I need people to be questioning this stuff. I don't want women to say anymore, why am I in this toxic relationship? You know, I want women to just know that that's a red flag, and that, oh, I didn't know what red flag even meant. You know, I want people to know that there are all of these tools available to them, and I want to make them more accessible. And even, you know, you asked about education and stuff. My parents never taught me about feminism, never taught me about politics or about systemic oppression, any of this kind of stuff. That this was all of a search of like my own endeavor.
Do you think that's right, or do you feel like there should be more education in terms of gender, sexuality, sex at a younger age? Like, do you think that should come from parents? I'm interested in knowing that.
I think it should, absolutely, because else you find out and you can end up inflicting that harm onto other people. We live in a white supremacist society. You end up buying into that idea if no one tells you that it's wrong, right? The way that people of colour are portrayed in the media, the way fat people are portrayed in the media, you buy into these narratives and then you treat people of colour and fat people as others, and you treat them like shit. So unless someone tells you, by the way, you're going to consume a lot of this kind of stuff, but I just want you to know that this is how it is. You know, you need someone to poke the hole in the facade that you're about to consume for the rest of your life. Definitely think there needs to be someone poking the holes in all of the stuff that we readily consume as normal, because it's not normal, it's been normalized. And there's a difference.
How do you feel that men can be more useful within intersectional feminism in terms of I suppose, like, reverse engineer this very outdated patriarchal society, yeah, the system that we do live in?
The way I view it is that it's like literally a machine. I always view it as like oppression as a machine in my head, and I refuse to be a cog in that machine that keeps it ticking. And I feel like to escape, to not be a cog in that machine, you have to be holding yourself accountable. And the one act of allyship that I always refer to when talking to men about feminism is when I was on a night out in a pub. This is like a physical barrier act of allyship you can do, and it's at no expense of their own, and also without being a savior. So these men were outside the pub, it's like a group of them, and I was stood on my own, and it was late at night, and I was waiting for my Uber, and these three men approached me. At first I was really intimidated, I didn't know what they were going to say, and they said, hey, do you mind if we watch you from a distance just to make sure you get home safe? And I was like, oh, okay, sure. So they stood about like 3 meters away from me, and they just kind of looked over to check every now and then. I was inevitably harassed by three different men. One guy tried to get me in his car, one guy tried to like touch me, this homeless guy was coming up to me and like grabbing me. And all of this stuff has happened to me. And every time one of the guys came over and pulled the guy away and took him away and then went back to the spot where they were standing until I got my Uber safely. They didn't want to linger for a conversation, which a lot of men do. They try to make it, hey, let me make sure you get home safe. And they're like, just stay with me and try and chat me into going home with them. It was none of that. It was, we're going to stand over there and intervene when necessary so you don't get harassed, and also not harassing you at the same time. So it was like this physical barrier where they came in, intervened, and also didn't harass me. It just shows, first of all, how low the bar is for men in terms of helping women, because I was absolutely blown away. I was like, wow, these men didn't harass me while also trying to mask it with this kind of helping me kind of way. And in terms of how men can challenge sexism and in their lives is to call out behaviours. And I know that's the number one thing that everyone always says, but it's so frustrating having to bite your tongue as a woman to kind of protect yourself, because you don't know what's going to happen if you speak up. So there are situations where, I guess, when you're just with your guys and they say stuff, it's so uncomfortable. I know that feeling. I have it with my friends all the time, my female friends, when they say stuff which is slightly not racist, but like I'm othering. They'll say something and it's like, oh, you can't say that. These people will listen to you. And when you're in a position of privilege in that way, you do have the power to change the world. Those uncomfortable moments where you feel like biting your tongue but don't, those conversations change the world. And that's my only kind of attitude that I would encourage anyone to adopt, is to just push through that need to be seen as this nice, agreeable person and just say something, because you will change. Your conversation that you have with your mate Brad about consent could literally stop someone from being raped. Absolutely. Because this the idea that we even have of rape is a woman being pushed down an alley, and that's definitely not how it happens most of the time. You know, 90% of cases of rape are by someone that the victim already knew. So, you know, men want to talk about it. Yeah, absolutely. There you go. So it's, this whole theory of being a nice guy, it's, well, actually 90% of rapists are technically nice guys. So it's about, because they don't know they're doing it. Like, it's this, we don't teach people to consent. And it's this, we've fostered this culture of not knowing what it is. People don't know they're being raped, and then people don't know they're raping people. So that one conversation you have with your mate to say, you know, do you know consent? Do you know about consent? Like, do you know what it is? Just sending them a checklist. Like, I sent my brother a consent checklist and he was blown away. He was like, what? I did not even know that. So it's about passing on resources, and that's all you can do. You can't, you know, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. So
do you think these conversations and codes of consent have changed in the sort of post Me Too Time's Up environment?
Yeah, they have changed, but also it's creating this resistance. So I've on a lot of like modeling jobs and stuff, I rarely actually interact with men who aren't feminists, because I don't make that choice. So I was on a job once, and there was this straight white guy, and he was going on, he found my Instagram account from being on the job with me, and he was like, don't you think it's a really hard time to be a white male right now? And I was like, mate, yeah, do you know what? It probably is, because you're finally being asked to question and interrogate how your actions are affecting everyone in your life. And, you know, obviously it's not a hard time to be a white male. What he means is it's horrible and uncomfortable because I have to be accountable for the ways I've abused women now, you know, because people are speaking up. And there's this quote floating around the internet that says something like, you know, when you come from a place of privilege, accountability feels like an attack and it feels like oppression. And it says it's not. It's simply asking you to be better and question and interrogate your behaviours to...
Or the people that have a problem with it, the people who have never been told no.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and have never had a... Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I've never had a problem with saying no to others either.
Well, Floss, it's been... I mean, this has been such a cool conversation.
Yeah, really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, my girlfriend is a huge, huge fan of your work, and actually,
that's amazing.
Yeah, I know she'll love listening to this, and she was, she was the one that turned me on to your work and suggested that I reach out to you.
Oh, good for her! Yes.
Yes. So, I mean, we have a lot of these conversations, you know, between us, and I suppose I just wanted to let you know that your work is one of the things that engages conversations that we have, you know. So, I think. Yeah, I don't know. It's just, I suppose it's cool for you to know that, you know, it's reaching a lot of places out there.
Yeah.
So just before we sign off, I'd like to ask you a question that we ask each of our guests on the podcast, which is, what are the three things that you believe are worth fighting for?
Okay, my right to say no, and for that to be unchallenged when I do say no. Consent and the universal understanding of consent. Expressing myself, and for all people, but especially marginalized people and queer people, to express themselves and have that unchallenged, and for people to be able to exist in a world that does not encourage them to mute their authentic self. That would be fucking beautiful.
Floss, thank you so much.
Thank you.
For giving me your time so generously. And I know so many of our listeners will be inspired by the messages in your work and your book, which is out now. Go and buy it. And I think also, you know, I think our listeners will really take a lot from looking at seeing where your journey goes next. I think that's so exciting.
Yeah, this is the first podcast I've done in a while. So I'm really excited to get this out as well.
Good. Well, I think, you know, it means so much to have these conversations. So
thank you. Cheers for having me.
Wicked. All right. Enjoy the rest of your day, Floss.
Thank you.
All the best.
Bye. Bye.
Thank you for listening to episode 3 of Things Worth Fighting For. And also to both Elizabeth Acevedo and Florence Given for their powerful words. Elizabeth's third book, Clap When You Land, came out last month. And Florence's book, Women Don't Owe You Pretty, is also out now. Take a look in the show notes for links and more info. We'll be back very soon with another episode, so stay tuned and don't forget to subscribe and give us a little rating if you enjoyed the show. This episode was brought to you by Acast and produced by Matthew Twaits.
Cheers, Matt.
And thanks to Courtney Aisha Mortimer at UROC for all her help and coordination skills. And now, to play you out, we're going to listen to History Has Its Eyes on You. See you next time.
Shivers down their spines. Be kind and never quit. 'Cause history
tree has its eyes on you. This tree has its eyes on you. Yeah, you. This tree has its eyes on you.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.